Hi everyone, I'm Jonathan Ciboni, founder and CEO of Luxury Insight, the leading data intelligence platform for luxury brands. Every 2 weeks, Godfrey Dini, Global Editor-in-Chief, and Olivier Guyot, Editor-in-Chief Friends of Fashion Network, interview the people who shape the industry of luxury, fashion, and beauty. Our guests share their personal journey and opinion on the current state of the market and what to expect for the future. You can find all episodes on luxuryinsight.com, social media, and wherever you want to listen to our podcasts. We hope you're going to enjoy this episode.
Good day, everyone. In today's podcast, we have the pleasure of meeting Thierry Andretta, who has been the CEO of Mulberry for the last, I believe, 8 years. And he's a man who's had a long and very fruitful career with many important luxury brands. He was CEO of Lanvin, I believe Moschino. He worked for the Gucci Group. He was also an executive at LVMH, and at one stage even the CEO of Buccellati, the great luxury jewelry brand. But today I think we're going to focus on his more recent job, which is Mulberry. So good, very good of you to come along today.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, you've been CEO at Mulberry since April 2015.
Correct.
When you replaced my namesake, Godfrey Davis. What were your key objectives when you first arrived?
Well, when you first arrived, it was to put the brand on an international evidence. The brand was really British focused, or UK focused, let's say this way, really looking on the internal market and not really considering an international expansion directly done, because they used to have a lot of wholesale, as a lot of the majority of a brand, but not really a retail. And so the strategy was clear, was to change the brand, moving directly to consumer and moving outside of the UK little by little.
Okay. You've invested in that process quite heavily in digital, I believe. When you arrived, there was practically no online sales. What would they be today?
Today, we are probably the best brand in terms of penetration of the luxury industry. We are at 37% of our retail and 31% if we consider franchisee wholesale, that are markets where we are not really doing digital. And when I joined, it was 7%. That was still a good percentage, really small, but not really done.
When you arrived, I think it was fair to say there had been a number of years of confusion about the brand. What its positioning was, what its price point was?
The positioning was, let's say, a little bit unusual because there was a tentative to go up in terms of luxury perception, but it was not exactly done also increasing at an acceptable level of quality. And so the work for us has been before to reassure the consumer that we have that consider Mulberry a luxury brand, and then working a lot on quality and quality perception. And today I personally think that we invest a lot in our factories in UK. So we are really proud because we have around 600 workers in 2 factories producing over 50% of our bags in the UK. The balance is done in Italy, is done in Europe mostly. We are really proud today because I consider that we have probably the best value for price in the luxury industry. But there has been tons of investment on every single point, because it's not only having the latest technology available, but it's also to make training craftsman people. And it's crazy because it's really interesting. We have an apprentice program since 2006. And today the majority of our top talent are coming out and they start the career as apprentice and they move little by little in the company. So it's quite interesting because today we have a really young generation able to make a difference in terms of quality and the way that we prepare and we produce our bag.
Oh, very good. Walpole, which is the United Kingdom's luxury federation, late last year, awarded you its Sustainability Brand of the Year award. So tell us a bit about what you've been doing in the regenerative area and in terms of the circular economy to get that award.
I would like to put this in context simply because I think it's interesting. The company was founded with a sustainability of 52 years ago, because the company has been founded in 1971. What does it mean? That it was a really good quality product made to last. And this was the origin. 3 or 5 years after that they start the company, they start receiving requests from customer to fix what was a bag, let's say, as an example, because the lining was broken or this kind of thing. And so they decided to offer a lifetime service that for me was the first example of circularity. So, and we found this. When I joined the company, I was so impressed because we had about 12 to 15 people doing only what I call lifetime service. So repairing bag that are coming back because the consumer has a certain affection for the bag and they don't want to put away, they want to have their bag fixed and return. So a few years ago when we were looking that we were potentially turning 50, so in 2021, we decided to move mostly, let's say, circularity and sustainability at the next level. And so we start engaging with tanneries. I still remember when we asked to the Scottish Leather Group to go to buy hides from 9 regenerative farming that we identify in Scotland because they were the one really respecting the soil, turning the things. And so we were sure that this hides were coming to the tannery mostly on carbon neutral approach. And I still remember they were looking at like, you are crazy, why you want to teach us what to do our business? Yeah, because we want to move the business to a different level and something. And now let's say that all the tanneries are really following this. Today, 100% of our leather, and we are in advance on our manifesto when we declare that it was done by 2023, we were able to have 100% of our leather coming from regenerative farming. So this means where the soil is fully respected and where there is a rotation about the way that they produce the leather is carbon neutral. On top of this, we are using the best tannery in the world. 50% around of our product is coming to us carbon neutral, obtained from the factories, from the tanneries. The other part we are offsetting a little bit because we want to be also consistent of this, still that the tannery are organized themselves. So we really move on this. We move on circularity because we were the first brand in 2021 to start, end of 2020, to start a pre-loved bag program. This is really working. We have an issue today, but it's simple that we are not able to buy enough bag to put on the market. This is an incredible...
Not enough to buy enough?
Enough bags to put on the market again. Because normally the customer that come back to us, they want their bag fixed to have a second life. Mm-hmm. And we propose to everyone to buy the bags. We are able to buy, but for example, we are not doing yet worldwide this kind of circularity because we don't have enough bags. So today is mostly working UK, is working in Europe on the West side, and is working in the US. And we are launching in China in a few months from now.
Okay. You've had a number of very classic bags. There was the famous Bayswater, I remember, of nearly a generation ago. More recently, you introduced the M-Zip and the Link, I noticed. How have they performed?
They are performing well. We have today a great mix, as I think a lot of other brands related to leather goods. So we have the historical bestseller that continue to perform. And then they have also there, they have a phase where up and down is related to fashion and moment and something. Bayswater turned 20 this year, so we are just did a launch. As a Family is our bestseller. The second one is Alexa, which is another historical bag from 15 years ago, well represented by Alexa Chang. For sure, then we have another bag that is also an historical one, that is the Lily. But after we also have a few bags that are coming from the generation when Johnny Coca was our creative director. So we have the Iris, we have the Amberly that are still in the top. And the M Family and the Link are just started, but they're selling quite well. They are quite modern. So it's good to have this mix between old bestseller and new bestseller.
Bags make up, I'm guessing, the majority of your sales, no?
Absolutely, yes. Bikes and small leather goods represent close to 90% of our sales.
Okay, okay. So it's not, you haven't really diversified into becoming a fashion label or such?
Not really. I think a lot of brands related to leather goods are using fashion just to generate traffic and sell at the end leather goods. In our case, we prefer for the moment to stay focused on leather goods.
And you expect that to be the case. You talked about... Burberry's history. Define the DNA of Mulberry. Sorry, Burberry.
Mulberry is, from my point of view, is the quintessence of a British of Britishness in leather goods quality and in leather goods also offer. So there is this contradiction between modernity and tradition that is typical from UK. Yeah. I will say that if we use the example that we use, the Bayswater is a classic bag. The Link or the M family are a lot more modern and more edge in terms of brand. So it's really this contradiction. We've always, anyway, an approach in terms of color palette that is typical British, that is really important for us. We spend a lot of time in all our colors offer, despite the classic one that everyone is selling, to be sure that they represent Britishness in a great way.
What do you define as British colors?
The classical British color is always a pink, as an example. So we are never missing a pink in our collection. But also when we found a tone is really a British tone. For example, we have a green that is called Mulberry Green. It's close to our package and is really what in terms of cars they call the Mulberry British green, so the racing green.
Okay.
So we check about to be sure that this is really represented.
What about international expansion? How has that progressed?
It's progressing really well. I think we were just out 10 days ago with our results. And international is growing. We are not yet at 50%. We are close. But for example, this year, that is the result because there have been a lot of investment on international. And this year, for example, we are up 46% on international and we are flat in the UK. The UK is a difficult market in this moment. And this is done really because we have finalized to acquire the majority of the territory, and now, little by little, they are coming back.
So, which territory?
So we start acquiring, we're taking control of China, including Hong Kong, Macau, and Taiwan.
Where previously you had a license or
previously it was a franchise.
Franchise. Yeah.
Then we did the same things in Korea. That was our second market. Then we did a JV in Japan and we acquired 2 weeks ago the control, the 100% of JV. We did Australia 6 months ago. We did Sweden close to 1 year ago. So we are little by little taking control of all the international markets.
So you think that can really generate a lot of higher growth is your hope, obviously.
We can generate growth, but especially we can be sure and prepared for the next generation that, in my opinion, being the leading company in terms of digital penetrations. We have our 37% of retail. Now we need to move on integration with this omnichannel. And omnichannel means that the customer can decide where he wants to start the journey with a brand digitally or in brick and mortar. The integration can only be done when you have a full control of the distribution, because we try for a lot of time to do a share new model with a franchise, it was mostly impossible. So,
What have you done in terms of the design of your boutique? So many brands nowadays make a lot of emphasis.
We have done a great agreement with a rising star on the British architecture, that is a lady called Faye Too Good. And she did an interpretation of a store concept that is quite interesting because it's a mix between English brutalism in terms of architecture with a typical signature in terms of color palette. So again, the importance of British color and signature furniture typical of the UK countryside. It's quite interesting. The first store open was Regent Street in London, so it's now 6 years old. And now we have a presence of this store all over the world. It's really interesting because it's a cozy ambience. You don't feel to be in a luxury environment that is pushing you to buy or things. It's comfortable. You spend time inside. And every time that we apply the concept in the previous store, we have an uplift in sales that is between 20 to 30%. So it's quite interesting. I think it's an interesting concept.
So it's a very measurable effect.
Yeah.
Measurable effect. Now, you have been quite outspoken last year, I know, about the decision of the British government and Rishi Sunak when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer to end VAT-free shopping for tourists in the UK.
Yeah.
And I know it had, we spoke earlier about it, had a very bad effect on your bond superstore. How do you think that can be changed? Do you think...
I think everyone is putting more and more pressure to change this decision because in our case, it's impacting... we used to do £11 million turnover on tax-free.
Where? On tax-free?
In tax-free in UK.
In UK, yeah.
In a year. So after the decision, we are still doing probably 2 million international tourists without the tax-free. Mm. So there is a big losses in terms of things. There is a losses that at the end is under employment, so under jobs, if you want. But the point is that we were discussing about Bond Street. Our store in Bond Street was doing 45% on tax-free. Since the end of the tax-free, that store that before was always the number one in UK became the number two and sometimes the number three behind the Covent Garden, that is a beautiful store in London, with a difference that Bond Street cost 10 times more Covent Garden in terms of rent. So for us, it was impossible to continue a store like this. And we have decided to took the decision to close the store. Fortunately, good enough that we were able to redeploy all the team, all the staff in other store in London because we have several. But it was a tough decision. And I think the government need to rethink this because it's really not working. I don't know any single brand that is happy in this moment in London in terms of performance. And this is impacting not only our luxury consumer, it's impacting hospitality, it's impacting restaurants, it's impacting theater. So it's impacting really a lot of jobs, in my opinion.
Okay, because the VAT also operated on theater tickets as well? No. But only on luxury goods.
Only on luxury.
But naturally, that was what attracted the international shopper there,
completely.
Because if not, they're going to go to Milan or Paris.
Completely. And if you think today, the tax-free level is over pre-COVID. So finally, they recover without the Chinese, because Chinese today, you only have the individual traveler, so the health individual, you don't have a group that used to come both in Paris or Milano or even London. And it's mostly done on American and Middle Eastern other things. And then, strange enough, because for sure, as an international or European tourist, you cannot enjoy anymore the tax-free in UK. But as a British passport holder, you can enjoy a tax-free shop outside of the UK. So now you have the opposite, that the British represent 10 to 12% of the tax-free in Europe coming to buy in Paris,
in
so
Paris,
they also enjoy the weekend or going to buy in Milano or some other places.
Okay. Now, you had group revenue, I saw last year, was up 4% to 159 million. That was despite these tough conditions
despite
in your,
this, yeah.
your key market, because Britain is still nearly is the majority of your sales.
It's close to 60%. Yes.
Okay, there. So, what are you expecting this year?
This year we expect a growth that will come for sure internationally, so over 40% growth in the first 12 weeks and for the moment is continuing at the same pace. UK is really a question mark. For the moment we are flat in the UK, but I think is still a acceptable result, let's say this way. Let's see what is happening in the UK. That's our point.
Okay. Your company is, I believe, owned by the, I always mispronounce the name, the Ong, Ong family, who own 56%. But you were recently also in the news, the reports that your minority shareholder, Mike Ashley, wanted a stake on the board, but you rejected that.
But if you want, the company is controlled by the Ong. They have about 57%. And Mike Ashley, as Fraser Group, has 36, 37. He was asking a position of the board, and then the position of the board is that we are looking for an independent member of the board.
Yeah.
But our strategy strategy is to grow internationally and to grow on direct to consumer, because our business today is 95% direct to consumer. So 85% is controlled by us. 10% is controlled by two franchises that we still have that are direct to consumer because they are monobrand. Store 5% only is the wholesale. So Mike Ashley, that is a successful man, a great businessman, and he has a great business, especially on Sport Direct, plus Fraser or Flannel. He's, I think, a brilliant guy, but with an experience that is mostly wholesale and, and UK market. Is not what we are looking for.
Okay. What did you learn at your other jobs at Lanvin or at Buccellati that you try to put into use in Mulberry?
Coherence related to be customer centric, because the focus for, I think, every company today is to be customer centric. I think there is a big evolution in try to do the market, what I call the marketing to one and not marketing. So when you marketing, you need to market Godfrey because you are here, or you need to market Thierry, knowing everything about the customer and try to offer the best service that you can or the best suggestion that you can. I think this is really what you learn. You learn this especially from hard luxury. So when I was in Buccellati, at that time it was clear that we were doing around 70% of our business with less than 100 customers, absolutely rich and fortunate. So these 100 customers, we used to know everything, where they were spending the holiday, when they were going to a hotel. So it's a complete. I think today every brand needs to move in this. You need to know more and more about your customer. And this, I think, is also where personally CRM has to go. And CRM means the application of artificial intelligence, because in our case, I think it will be in our industry, I think it will be really easy. It's an extremely sophistication on CRM, knowing everything about your customer.
So that's how you think data should be used, is to amass as much as possible.
Absolutely.
How do you go about gathering all that information?
But even this is difficult. Sometimes when you think, and on this I try to be really clear, what are the political impacts on everything? I've been recently in China. And it was 3.5 years that I was not going there. So I tried to fix a long meeting to understand related to Mulberry, what our consumer were looking for Mulberry, what other brand that they were looking. So, and I met Tmall, I met Little Red Book, I met Baozun, that is the digital distributor for the majority of a luxury brand working on every platform. They have all the data that we call artificial intelligence available, and immediately available. And every time that I was asking a question to go more deep, and this was not in their presentation, the data was available. So immediately available, because they simply need to look on the computer and taking out the data. But the big difference, and that's why I'm going to the political party, that for me is a little bit an obsession, is that the younger customer and the younger generation ask to receive a lot of services. You don't need to opt in. In Europe, you need to opt in, so it's impossible. And let me use an example, Godfrey, because it's a real shock. We went to Chengdu to visit the shopping mall, so it's a 20 million city, people living city in the center of China. And our general manager received a text on her phone: "Welcome, Cinzia. We know that you like a Thai food. Here we have two Thai restaurants. One is fully booked. The other one, you can have a table at 12:45. So this is the level of service that the younger generation, I think worldwide, personal opinion, would like to receive. In Europe, we cannot send this text because you need to opt in. So you need to go in the website of the shopping mall. You need to sign in, you need to opt in, you need to create the credential, and then potentially you can receive something. So when you have this kind of barrier, it's sure that you give the opportunity to China to go 10 times faster than us, because here everything is making...
But sorry, why are they able to use the information?
Because there is the law related to your confidentiality and privacy. Yeah. And so, for example, in our case, let me talk only about Mulberry. We used to have over 2 million people in our database in terms of customers. When the law was finally mandatory, we lost over 1 million of contacts.
Because people wouldn't click accept.
Because people wouldn't click. And that's the big difference. So I think that even artificial intelligence, we can go faster, but we need to have also someone thinking about what the level of service that really the younger generation
would like. That kind of right to privacy laws that they passed, do you think was a mistake?
I think that in this case is a mistake, personally. I think you need to be protected, but you can opt out. Not opt in. That's the different term of philosophy.
We have a lot of young people listening to our podcast who would like to get a career in the fashion, luxury, creative world. What are three bits of advice you would give to a young man or woman starting out today who's about to go to college or college?
Well, the first thing is always to be open to learn, because I personally consider, and now I'm in my last phase of career in terms of age, that you can learn from everyone. There is always someone that can give you a point of view that is relevant, that you are not able to think on your own. So it's mostly listening to people, try to analyze something. The other thing is try to be yourself, if you trust something, continue to trust what you are doing and advancing. And the third thing that I think is potentially is the more important is that you will learn sooner than later that alone you cannot do a lot of things. So you need to learn how to work in team and how to have a team working with you, sharing the same direction, strategy, goal, objectives, because it's the way to accelerate and going better and be successful.
Finally, as a French man of Italian origin, living in London and running a prestige UK luxury brand, has Brexit been a success or a failure?
In terms of business, I think it's a failure. But a failure because it's related to what we discussed before, the tax-free. The end of tax-free is a big mistake from a government. And I think that both every other country in Europe is more than happy that this happened in the UK, because we are today over in Europe pre-COVID level in terms of tax-free, enjoying even the British buying outside of the UK. And UK is the only country that is really suffering related to this. After is a democracy decision that I cannot discuss, but in terms of business has impact for us in a negative way.
Jerry Andretta, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for listening to the Luxury Insight and Fashion Network podcast. If you like this episode, subscribe to our channel to discover more exclusive insights from leaders of the industry. You can find all our episodes on luxuryinsight.com, social media, and wherever you listen to your podcasts.